Kay, welcome. And who are you with, Kay?
I'm with the firm of A&J Halco Services, Inc.
A&J, I'm sorry.
Halco, H-O-W-C-O.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, anybody else on the call?
Yes, ma'am. Courtney Sartain, who's also one of my staff members, is also on.
Okay, great. Welcome, Courtney.
Hello.
And we have a few people here in the room. And then I know we have another council member that's on his way, but while we're waiting on just a couple more minutes for Mike to get here. Donnie, would you like to put in your face yourself?
I'm Donnie Green. I'm with Central Texas Council of Government, the Area Agency on Aging and Aging and Disability Resource Center.
Michael.
Hi, everybody. This is Michael West. I'm with the Texas Department of Agriculture, and I work in the Office of Rural Affairs and work also with Becky Dempsey and with the CDBG program.
Jamila.
Jamila Lee, and with the Hog Foundation, serving me today.
Well, I appreciate everybody participating. Let me try to keep this at 1 hour. Try to stick with the agenda. And let's see. Mike is on his way, so he probably doesn't need to hear this first introduction part. So what I've been doing is just trying to give people just a brief introduction of the Housing and Health Services Coordination Council. The council is codified in the Texas Government Code. It's been in existence since 2010, I believe. Is that right, Donnie? And we are required to produce and create a biennial plan. And the purpose of that plan is to lay out recommendations that the council has regarding expanding efforts to increase service-enriched housing for people with disabilities and the elderly. And so the council meets once a quarter, and we work towards developing this biennial plan. It goes to the Office of the Governor and the Legislative Budget Board August 1st of every even numbered year. So what we're wanting to do during this last year, giving an overview, during this last year, we contracted with the Technical Assistance Collaborative, and they produced a report that was included on the agenda. The link to the report was included on the agenda, but it was a State of Texas Comprehensive Analysis of Service-Enriched Housing Finance Practices. And with that report, they did a couple of things. The first thing was to look at other states and what other states are doing related to expanding service-enriched housing. And then the second part of that report is developing recommendations about what we in Texas can do to expand the access to service-enriched housing. And so I encourage you, if you haven't already, to review that report. It's a pretty lengthy report. It takes a little time to get through it. But it is a good report, and it really lays out some of the recommendations. And so
you could give up his prescription for Ambien.
So, but the report included a number of recommendations. And so what the council chose to do was to really focus on three of those recommendations, which is what then prompted our three work groups. So there are two other work groups. If anybody on the call or in the room is interested in participating in those other ones, work group one is about adding additional resources to increase service-enriched housing. This second work group is about expanding service-enriched housing in rural and mid-sized cities. The third work group that met last week is related to creating a series of incentives to increase service-enriched housing. And so today at the council meeting, in fact, we had a brief discussion and overview about the Qualified Allocations Plan, which is one funding source for service-enriched housing and the largest resource for service-enriched housing. And so that's kind of how we got here today. And so this work group we're really wanting to focus on implementation strategies. So the recommendation is let's increase service-enriched housing in rural and mid-sized cities, and what we're really looking to you all to do is, okay, now how do we do that? What can we do, and where do we go? And then eventually that will get included in the report that goes to the Office of the Governor and Legislative Budget Board. Mike?
One request, and that is you quit attempting to fool old people. This would be the TAC 7 group, not the TAC 2 group.
Okay.
When I kept looking at TAC 2, and I couldn't find anything in TAC 2 that had to do with rural or small, mid-sized cities.
I was thinking specifically of you, trying to make it simple. 1, 2, and 3.
So I flipped through the rest of my tab. And
wow.
Found TAC 7, which met the description of the group.
I apologize for confusing you. My attempt to make it simpler clearly did not work.
But that was the only issue, because we got this report that's got like, what, 15 or 16 TAC something in it.
Yeah.
But keeping consistent with the, work group 1, work group 2, work group 3, the TAC numbers ought to follow the report so that.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that. Didn't mean to confuse anybody. So the first thing on the agenda was just to, or the second thing on the agenda was just to look at the work group plan. So that is basically, I'm trying to keep them to an hour and do them every other month. And so I kind of looked back at August 1st of 2014, and I'm going to plan to schedule, if we need that many, about 5 of these phone calls to try to get to what I'm going to need to include in the report. So, and then any homework in between. So the first thing I did was to give you the access to that report. So let's just go ahead and we could start there. Did anybody have any comments, questions regarding the report and any of the recommendations, if anybody had a chance to scan through that? Okay. What I did, and this was not posted on the website, what I did was I tried to go through the report to really pull out the pieces that were related to this specific recommendation. And so perhaps we could maybe just start there. The document that I shared with the council members really started out with the recommendations that TAC had after reviewing Texas and reviewing some of the other states. And the overarching recommendation is about pooling resources. I think to sum it up real simply, they looked at and recommended that Texas explore service-enriched housing, looking at the work that's already been done by our rural housing expansion. Oh, excuse me, the rural housing work group, which is actually the next report that was included in the agenda, that look at the work that's already been done and those reports that have already been written. And then they went on to say engaging the Texas Veterans Commission and the Texas Department of Agriculture related to the community development block grant to leverage their resources. And so I just wanted to share that during this last legislative session, the Texas Veterans Commission, a representative from the Texas Veterans Commission, is included on our council. And he attended his first meeting today. So we do have the Texas Veterans Commission represented on the council, and I think that will give us some opportunities to really work more closely with them and to leverage their resources with ours. And then we also have always had the Texas Department of Agriculture representatives on the council. And today, as a matter of fact, Becky Dempsey, who's the council rep, gave a brief overview about the Community Development Block Grant. And I thought it was, she said it so simply in the beginning, because I'm coming in new to the housing world, and so she just said it real simply that the in Texas, the Community Development Block Grant is really used for the infrastructure, and then CDHCA and other housing organizations are then really focused on the housing. And so that made it super simple for me. We're working on infrastructure, sewers, and all other kinds of things related to then having that infrastructure in place and to look at other resources for housing. So gave a brief overview on that, and that'll be included in the transcript that I will post on the website if anybody wants to hear her overview of today. So their recommendation was really about pooling resources. They also mentioned the Texas State Affordable Housing Council, did I say that right? Affordable Housing Council, TSHAC, effectively to partner with agencies.
It's a corporation. Texas State Affordable Housing Corporation.
They are
a bond funding agency outside of TDHCA, able to source state bonds.
Thank you. So I think this recommendation, the way I read it, and you all chime in, was how could we look at their little pot of money, their little pot of money, their little pot of money, and how could we take a little bit to those pot of money and make a new pot of money? Is that, I mean, that's way oversimplifying, but that's sort of how I read that, is how could we all work together to maybe create another resource that would be focused on rural housing? Is that?
Well, I wasn't sure. I definitely think that a big piece of it, and that may be all of it, but I was wondering if it meant kind of information sharing as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just creating opportunities or, you know, mandates for housing and service providers to collaborate. And in this morning's meeting, we talked about, you know, bringing housing training to labor managers. And so, again, I'm not sure if that's a fit. But, you know, I think there are a couple of different ways to define resources. One would be fiscal resources, and the other would be information sharing. And I think there's value in both.
Can everyone on the phone hear Donnie all right?
You might, just so we can hear that are so far away up here in the panhandle. If you just hit her high points, and that way we won't maybe ask a dumb question.
I'm trying to scoot the phone over just a little bit.
It was a question, a question along with a comment. Are we looking at pooling different funding sources, or are we looking at sharing fiscal resources as well as information sharing, kind of in kind?
Well, and once again, my name is Kay Howard and have worked in the housing program since 1981 when it was under HUD, and then when we transferred it as a block group over to Texas in 1983. And we had in the past had what they call block grants based on a 3-year increment that allowed us to do not only infrastructure but also to do housing. And so my question to Michael is that anything that the PDA, since they've taken over all these programs, has thought about doing? And specifically, because I'm talking about the rural areas, you know, that are under 10,000 in population, maybe.
Well, I'm not sure. This is Michael. I'm not sure if Becky addressed that to any extent this morning in the previous meeting. I know she did point out that our current Texas CDBG program is focused on public infrastructure. And that includes public infrastructure for community development, as well as a variety of other purposes, including funds that might go to colonias or the staff volunteer program or a couple of the others, Kay, that you're familiar with.
Right. Okay. Well, that was just in tooling resources. I've often wondered how HUD felt about that these funds had always, one of the activities is housing activities, other than principally doing yard services, you know, when we're putting first-time services in for water or sewer. So I was curious as to whether PDA and any of their upcoming plans that they would be presenting to HUD had thought about including either a funding mechanism there to do it, set aside a housing fund that might help towards, in the rural area, servicing and or elderly housing, besides the TDHCA program.
Right. My understanding is that right now those funds and that mandate is with TDHCA, and that TDA is not currently contemplating moving funds from the current community development and infrastructure purposes toward housing. We are reviewing the variety of uses for the funds within the categories that currently exist. That's kind of that's something that we do annually. And so that's being reviewed.
Okay.
Mike, do you have a question?
Showing acres, what is the status of, in my age-old mind, of the RD housing program where rural development did have funds for the construction of affordable housing in smaller communities and outside? Is that still alive? Is that program available, or has that shut down?
So far as I know, it's not there anymore.
That was the one way that you could put affordable housing in the rural and small areas.
All right.
In fact, I worked on the affordable housing side, and we in Texas developed a liaison with the rural development offices to bring training on affordable housing and fair housing and all the new stuff that flowed through HUD and bypassed them because they weren't in HUD. But they came under the same requirements. And it was a good partnership and work, and that's what I'm trying to figure out. But I see one of the things that our brainstorming should do would be to try to find a way to help those communities identify resources that may or may not be available or partnership or things like that. For example, we helped a community group in Snyder, Texas, that used two RDA funding to build elderly and housing for disabled. And they came up and had the capacity to do a third and got turned down because they already had two. So we took them into the HUD at that time, 811-202 program to do a 48-unit program. But my answer is that Snyder is somewhere between, I never heard of it, you can't get there from here. I mean, it sits out between Lubbock and Odessa, I guess you can say somewhere out there. And so their ability to access and have knowledge. So the question is, how do we identify the communities that want to do this? And then what could we do or what could we suggest? Some sort of package, sort of like the training modules that were done under the 811 program that would be available to help them guide themselves into these programs. But I see that as the issue, that they're not big enough to attract the big guys. They don't have the resources that are in cities, and so they need, I'll say, education, training, guidebooks, or whatever method that we could put out there or facilitate putting out there to help.
Well, I will point out that we get calls every week, if not every day, from communities that are just desperate for housing, especially rural communities, and especially rural communities that are currently involved in the various oil shale plays. And, of course, they're not focused on housing for disadvantaged or disabilities or any specific population. They want housing for people coming in to take jobs. And so I think one of the things that could come out of this would be to acknowledge the very high rural need for housing, and that if anything, one of the tasks here would be to ensure that the priorities that this committee is looking at are identified in the priorities for those communities that are out there looking for housing anyway, so that they don't lose sight of current needs in their community and the needs of family members and people that may be coming to town to take jobs. So anyway, I thought that was something important to do.
Okay. This is Kay Howard again. Can I kind of, with the communities that I work with, can I kind of tell you what their game plans have been? Since we are covering so many of the areas from Van Horn all the way up to the Lynn Odessa area, Rankin, McCamey, coming over there. Snyder, of course, is east of us. It's between Abilene and Lubbock, Texas on I-20. Most of my city managers and mayors have taken the position that we're going to take advantage of the PDHCA program, which is rehabilitation, owner-occupied rehabilitation, and reconstruction as needed, to help replace their aging infrastructure. And, of course, when those affordable homes are being built, they have all of the recommendations and requirements that we must have for special needs at that point as a no-step front entry, you know, the hallways and bathrooms and all of those being accessible. So we're building some infrastructure if they would have to, those owners ever have to leave there, that we've got property that could be used for people with special needs. And obviously a lot, since this is benefiting low to moderate income people, we are helping elderly as well as people, married couples maybe, that their children were all left home, and even young couples with children who've been left grandmother or granddad's home. That we've been able to do with them. So we're trying to establish that attitude that as long as those funds are available, we're going to keep applying and seeing if we can have people qualified that will eligible income, principal residence, and so forth and so on, the programs. And it's been working very well out here in West Texas. What we are finding is that in trying to build adequate housing is financing for those that, where we do have an influx of people coming in because of the fracking that's going on in the regions, and them having to be, like in the case of Snyder, the city of Snyder and the county are developing their own development areas there. They're going to put in the infrastructure for housing to come in. They're putting up the money for that, plus they're building a lot of man camps. And I believe that they have all of those that the other gentleman mentioned about with the manufactured housing. I think all of those spots are all taken. I think they're totally full of every part of their development that they have done in that area. Once again, it's just finding the resources and the money to put together when you're talking about special needs or elderly, you know, if they're already in a home, you know, trying to bring it up and modify it to meet their needs, whatever those needs may be, based on their lifestyle and so forth and so on. But the second thing is that a city wants to look at it, wants to be sure that it's totally brought up the code as best as we can, and not just piecemeal it, if I may put it that way.
And so that was HRA, our Homeowner Rehabilitation Assistance?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I just wanted to be sure that's what you said.
Yes, that is the program that most of our small areas are using, and including our counties. We have a lot of counties that apply as well.
That's good. That's helpful information. Great.
Are they concentrating on single family, or are they trying to do some sort of multifamily program along with it?
Some of our communities that are big enough, like Sweetwater, Snyder, and some of those we've tried to look at some of the tax credits, you know, so that they could do multifamily. We've tried to start in Slayton, Texas, looking at multifamily there. It's fitting into the programs that that meet that need on the housing tax credit side, which is PDHCA again. But then, you know, it's the developers that come in and do that, and so they've been trying to attract them. I know the city of Slayton is, and Sweetwater has looked at it as well, trying to accommodate that. I don't know if you were out at the Snyder area or know about it, but just a little bit south of there at Winters, we had a company come in from California that built in wonderful, not multi-level, you know, not it's single single story is what I call it, homes out there for people to rent. And the only thing that they misjudged in that development, because it's still very good, is what are available rent levels and meeting the credit qualifications then that were required on that on a private development like that. But those are the ones that when they're trying to pursue those, and of course a lot of our developers that are using the tax credit program, they like to come to places like Lubbock, you know, Midland, Odessa, Abilene, those kind of areas, a little bit where it's got a little bit more population than some of our other communities do.
Yeah, the issue is that I'll say disinterested developer that's going to build a tax credit property is going to probably look at, won't look at anything under 100 units. It's awful hard to get a big time developer that's very competent. Most of them want 200, but in the tax credit world, 100, 150 is probably the minimum they're going to do. And that's the nut I see, is how do you get, and your what can they pay for rent is another critical issue, because it costs just as much to build an apartment in Snyder as it does in Dallas.
That is correct.
You know, you're paying the same or more for concrete. In many cases, you're going to have to import your subs that are apartment building experience. And so the question is either educating the local people who have development capacity, here we go to the QAP, incentivize the development of smaller multifamily developments in rural communities by having a set aside.
Could you say that one more time, please, Mike?
To incentivize a developer to put a multifamily project in a rural or small area by having a set aside specifically for, a 50 unit or less development. And there would be a population criteria, you know, in an area where the population center is a number less than 20,000, less than 10,000. But you've got to find some way to get the people that have the capacity to go develop a project they wouldn't even look at otherwise. Because if you can do that with the credits, you can get the prices down that you can hold the rent, and then you can also, have a decent project that will be self-sufficient and be maintained and will still be there 20 years later doing what it was supposed to do. Maybe doing it in conjunction with the city. That's another way to do it, is a jointly owned, where the city is a partner in the deal, so that when you do that, you can get advantages through impact fees, through partial tax abatements. Even in addition to tax credit, the partial tax abatement, so that your operating costs will be low enough to offer the rents that local folks can.
So you're familiar with the QAP, Qualified Allocation Plan. We already have a set-aside in there for rural development, right? So TDHCA is required to award with a certain percentage to rural. So tell me, when you say incentivize, that's above and beyond the set-aside that's already in the QAP?
Well, I have not read the current QAP, so I don't know how many units, if you will, or what kind of set-aside they have.
It's a percent, so it's like 15%, I think, is at risk, nonprofit, and then I think it's a 5% that has to go to rural. And so there's already statutorily required set-asides in the QAP for those three different categories. I may have the percentages wrong, but I know it's those three. It's at risk, nonprofit, and then rural. And so what I've heard you maybe alluding to is something above and beyond that set aside, maybe.
You can hope that they go above the legislatively required set aside and increase in one
place. So maybe additional points when they're being scored.
Yeah.
Additional points for developing multifamily housing in smaller rural. If they're willing to do that, it would give you more points, right? Okay. I just want to make sure I understood that.
And Don, brand new to the legacy process, are there any types of incentives for ensuring the provision of support services?
Yes, the QAP has a laundry list, and unfortunately, gamesmanship is the way you get tax credits. And developers take the list of how you get extra points, and they'll tick things off. Developed a property in Oklahoma where one of the things that we found that the developer had agreed to was that every Wednesday they would have fresh baked cookies available. I mean, it sounds stupid that it was in there. And, you know, we will provide special thanks for the residents, and they wrote in this thing, and it's there 40 years. And so that's the problem, is in order to get enough points to get a tax credit award, you got to check all the boxes.
Yeah.
And in many cases, it's extremely difficult to fulfill all the boxes.
It
seems to me that it's collaboration and integration of goals that a potential developer should provide a workable plan for that collaboration. For example, you know, when you have a tenant who's experiencing a mental health crisis, what agency are you going to call? And, you know, which staff people, I mean, to really compel them to do their research. And I know we write lots of letters of support, but they're very general. And it would be nice if, again, if those developers had a fairly specific plan that's grounded in local research so that, again, if there's a tenant in need of services like a physical disability or a mental disability or an intellectual and developmental disability, that at the very least that property manager would know
What you're describing is the requirements for the 811 grant applications.
Those are higher.
That requires a letter of agreement, if you will.
Right.
It requires a team of people, a developer, a service provider, and another one, that those are tied together with the application. So if that application is awarded, there is already the services and all that are identified.
Right.
The agencies are in there.
And I think, again, that's a higher standard than the QAP. I don't think that's been required as part of the QAP, but maybe,
that might be a way.
Maybe a lesser requirement, because all communities will be served by a local mental health authority, an area agency on aging, an aging and disability resource center. And, you know, I think the most successful service-enriched housing will involve active engagement of those parties. And so I think you're going to have a more successful development if you require proof that, at the very least, some research has been done, but ideally that developer has moved a step beyond that to kind of develop a plan for provision of services.
I do know in the current draft QAP, developers, if they choose to develop supportive housing property or project, they get 2 additional points for that. And then if you look in the draft QAP, it has a list of what services you're going to provide, and you can pick among those services, correct? Some of those services.
So, again, if we're looking at increasing the supply of service-enriched housing, there's already a criterion, but, you know, perhaps the work group could recommend that the weighting be increased from 2 points to X points.
Mm-hmm. So increase the points that a developer would receive for doing supportive housing. And supportive housing is different than service-enriched housing. So,
So, which raises a good question for any service given for service-enriched as opposed to supportive housing.
Yeah.
And if not, again, in terms of incentivizing, that might be a good vehicle.
I feel like that's enough strategy. With the rural housing component having, I'll say, being defunded at the federal level, what are the now sources of money that will build the property there? Because that was dedicated, and it was the source of providing housing, and all of a sudden it's gone away. And HUD is not putting new Section 8 out there. And there's no new, quote, HUD-backed affordable housing, other than a couple of the loan programs. But those are not going to pencil out in a small area.
And again, it's broader than the housing piece. I mean, because we have housing in rural communities, and it's $50 in one-way trip to go get a carton of milk. And so both resources need to be easily available. And, you want to go to communities that, have a robust array of resources. It's kind of chicken and the egg.
So other thoughts on that recommendation?
If I can, I'm Kathy Tyler. I'm not on your...
Hi, Kathy.
Board. Hi.
Nice to meet you in person.
You are.
I work some with the Rural Development Program, so I just wanted to say that most of those programs still are in place. They just don't have the funding, and the funding has declined over the years.
Like the 811 program is fixing funded. It's all going into a project-based
middle system. It's very easy to think that they don't exist anymore, so the funding is so small.
And everybody knows RDA, is that what you refer to?
I call it was rural development in the days when I was dealing with it. Actually, it was something other than that.
Farmer's
Home, and then it was rural development. But there were just a ton of what I would call safe, decent, sanitary housing built in small areas of rural communities. We looked at the portfolio in the Arkansas-Missouri border area, and the one that they asked us to look at, 36 properties in about 20 miles, because there were so many small old farming communities that, 500 people or something like that, and they would have 8 units here and 4 units there and 16 over here.
Was that USDA money?
Yes, sir.
No.
Okay. All funded and run by USDA. In fact, we helped them write some manuals from the HUD side because they were trying to improve their monitoring and give the owner something that would set standards form, and we worked with the folks in Washington for a while to try to help. Like I said, we had a great relationship with the Office of Texas, who was actually, I think, based in Waco, or was the lead. But with no new money into that program, the question is, how do you develop housing that will meet current standards?
So moving on, let me just maybe stay back. I guess sort of what we just briefly talked about initially was just really looking at, I think, Mike, your comment was, Michael, I'm sorry, really focus on in this biennial plan what the need is out there for rural housing so that we can enlighten our legislators about what need is out there. And I know I just pulled down a report, Low-Income Housing Tax Credit, Overcoming Barriers to Affordable Housing in Rural America. I've kind of, and then I know, I think, Kathy, you sent me the document. So there's several different reports I just haven't had a chance to go through that I think we could really find some references that could help us tell that story. And then I think the other thing was, Kay, you really talked about the homeowner rehabilitation assistance and how can we, you know, your communities are really utilizing that, but how could we maybe disseminate that information so that other communities are understand more about how to access those funds might be a recommendation. And then incentivize developers to put so some way in the qualified allocation plan to incentivize developers to put those multifamily projects in rural areas, perhaps jointly working with the cities, maybe a jointly owned project. And then the other was increasing points for choosing supportive housing or maybe even have specifically service-enriched housing in the qualified allocation plan and what that may look like.
Supportive housing as assisted living?
No, it's and somebody might know better than I, but it's just it's to support people with special needs.
Okay.
And so special
halfway
needs. What I've seen is just additional services like getting your GED. What are some of the other things? Transportation's a big one. So it's services that someone might need for special needs. But it's a broader term than service-enriched housing because it includes different populations. So our service-enriched definition for the council is people with disabilities and the disabled. People with special needs in the qualified allocation plan includes other populations, like women of domestic violence, for example. And so the services that are listed aren't typically what you and I would think of as services for people with disabilities. But I think one thing, and I'll maybe try to channel developers, and maybe you could chime in, you know, if we have so many requirements for that option, is that going to, how do I want to say that?
Disincentivize. Because I can do it easier somewhere else.
Or do a different type of, maybe there'll be more people that will choose elderly or more people that will just choose general. And, you know, so I just something to kind of toss around if we have so many requirements. Like I looked at the QAP and said, what about if we make the minimum room size bigger to account for people, you know, that might have attendance or things like that? Well, you know, then what are the unintended consequences of that? Well, then the price goes up, right?
Priced them out.
And so there were things like,
to a great extent, a lot of this is a zero-sum game. If you only have so many incentives and you begin increasing requirements for one area or another, no matter how meritorious it is,
right.
It's at the expense of some other,
exactly.
Something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the increased square footage of one room or another, that's at the expense of other rooms or at the expense of affordability,
right.
Or at the expense of eating up more of the incentive for fewer people.
Right, yeah. I would encourage you all to go through that qualified allocation plan, and Cameron Dorsey is the director of our multifamily finance unit, and he was at our council meeting today, and, you know, I don't think I'm speaking out of turn, you know, just by repeating what he said, is they don't get a lot of comments from the advocacy world, they get mostly comments from developers, and so I really think, you know, for this effort, really looking at, I really tried to pour through it, and I looked at some of the minimum requirements, for example, for if you choose supportive housing, and I'll not remember all of those things, but you don't have to have energy efficient, you don't have to have a ceiling fan, or you don't have to have, there were some things that you don't have to have if you choose supportive housing, where you do, and so my first question was, oh, well, why would you not have the same requirements for someone that's in a supportive housing? And so, you know, I do think that it's really good to have, you know, a different perspective. So I would encourage all of you to look at that qualified allocation plan. And it is open for public comment only until October 21st. And but that's not to say that as we generate some of these recommendations, there'll be a 2015 QAP and a 2016 QAP. So there's always going to be time to do that. So, okay, well, great. I just wanted to make sure I captured those and try to capture all of these. The next thing we talked also briefly today about are the Veterans Affairs Supportive Housing, so those VASH vouchers. And I did just briefly go through and look at four or five public housing authorities in Texas that have partnered with the VA medical centers. They four or five of those were just recently awarded four vouchers out of 2013 funds. But then I just went on the website and Googled, and so none of this is like official, but I just went and looked and see, well, where are other veteran medical centers? And there's several others across the state that I'm not aware of have accessed those vouchers or working with public housing authorities. And so
had a man want to come in and had an agreement with the VA to build housing on the hospital ground.
Okay.
And in many cases, the first population was disabled or homeless veterans. Mm-hmm. The city of Kerrville shot it down twice and will not allow it, but we don't want that kind of housing in Kerrville. So you got an issue there, where some of the veterans facilities are being held back from doing any kind of supported housing by the community and some of that community.
And that's always a challenge, isn't it? How do you fight the NIMBYism?
I don't know if Waco's one of them. You know, Waco's got a great facility. Waco. Mm-hmm.
No, I think Waco was one that I had identified as not being one that
Kerrville almost, although except that it's close to San Antonio, it almost meets the small area qualification that we're doing.
Mm-hmm. As a mid-sized city.
Mm-hmm. I would think, this is Kay Howard again, that in this day and time, with our impediment program in place, do the fair housing and the suit that was brought against the state of Texas, we may need to always relook at our actions and where we want housing to come in and where we do not. It can adversely affect the community if they're not very careful about how they handle that. That struck me real close when I saw that after attending some of the fair housing workshops and different things across the nation, that we need to make sure that that might need to be reapproached, is what I'm trying to say, by the city of Kerrville, because you could lose all of your funding from HUD if you've had any, or any federal funds, if the evidence is there that equal opportunity in housing for those less fortunate than the rest of us has been denied.
Well, Kerrville sort of lives with a different mentality.
Yeah, well, we do out here in West Texas. You're right.
Let's go out in the backyard and pitch hand grenades.
I just think that sometimes when that had been, maybe 4 years ago, if that was 10 years ago, you might be able to do that, but you cannot do that nowadays. You have to rethink how you need to handle that. And that was just a comment.
Well, I appreciate your comment. And obviously, that's not what they told them when they wouldn't let them do it. But it was the motivation behind what they were doing to not bring the housing
on
the grounds. It was zoning and density and things of that sort.
And they may have, and just pure speculation, they may have met other fair housing related standards in other ways across the town. I had no idea.
Right. I've often wondered, and y'all enlighten me once again, this is Kay Howard, is the Community Reinvestment Act that we've all heard so much about in parts and in different ways, it would seem like to me, particularly with banks being able to go in anywhere, particularly cities of size like Kerrville or, you know, any of these areas like that where you have Wells Fargo or you have a national banks Chase coming in, is there not within their means to help maybe developers or cities use those monies for these type of housing programs? Does anyone know?
My understanding, and I am not an expert in CRA, but it doesn't give you an advantageous financing necessarily, but what they do is underwrite loans that have higher risk than they would normally underwrite, but they don't necessarily give you a break on the rates or their requirements. So you're really just talking about underwriting lower debt service coverages, higher risk as far as where you're putting it versus the rental population. And another program I'm not, unfortunately, that familiar with that might work in this area would be the Federal Home Loan Bank.
Right.
The Federal Home Loan Bank has loans that they give that as you get a development built, if you will, or if you're doing a rehab, as you get that rehab and you perform, that loan can turn into a grant. So
right.
You move that element of debt service, and that might work in the smaller areas. And generally, the Federal Home Loan Bank is crying for people to apply for their funds.
And that's also the ag banks, isn't it, across the state of Texas that give home loans and stuff?
That I'm not familiar with.
Okay. I was just trying to think of other resources of money that would help maybe developers underwrite, like you said, underwrite the loans. It because they all have money, you know, that they have available. They're just not necessarily putting it out. And I thought if it was a public-private proposition and proposals that might go forth, that would help with utilizing or having them feel more comfortable in underwriting the loans.
So one of the other things that I gave you is the Rural Housing Expansion Program, and that was a program that CHCA offered. It was a couple of years ago, and it was through our Housing Trust Fund. So I just gave you access to that link. But this year, the Housing Trust Fund was focused on two programs, and that was the Amy Young Barrier Removal Program and our Bootstrap Program. And so that Rural Housing Expansion Program is no longer in existence at this time, but we were able to, I think it was $11 million of general revenue that did go to the Housing Trust Fund, which some of that goes to the Veterans Commission, but that is funds that are being utilized for Amy Young Barrier Removal and Bootstrap Program.
That will always be a recommendation that they reestablish that program for rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
That money be made available, mm-hmm. or a portion of it.
Okay.
Build a nice 6-unit property for $1 million with a small little area.
Mm-hmm. Is anyone familiar with that program a couple of years ago? Okay.
We were fortunate enough to be able to do this.
Okay.
A wonderful program. We ended up doing rehabilitation at farm worker owned homes, but our original concept is to do farm worker, a small farm worker complex, just as you're talking about in Plainview. We weren't able to follow through on that, so put them in rehab, which was really wonderful. And the nice thing about the expansion program, it had a capacity building portion to it as well. Also, very needed in rural areas, so the developers can increase, or nonprofits can increase their capacity to develop. Okay.
Thank you, Kathy. And, you know, I think it was Mike that talked about in the meeting today about quantifying, you know, I don't think that's the right word, but, you know, how we can basically show, you know, the legislature or whomever that those funds are being utilized and, you know.
It was in reference to getting their support for a new program is to go out and, you know, how much does it cost? You got to be able to show them what, not only the need, but you got to show them what the dollars you're asking for will do to make that. I've got to have that somewhere to identify a champion of supported housing or servicing this housing in the legislature. Asking why I dedicate this on.
Okay.
Well, speaking of state leadership, after the election, there will be a new governor, possibly a new state governor.
New lieutenant governor?
Possibly. I'm hearing that today. I'll be meeting it. Part of the, I think, one strategy would be to make sure that we're able to get the word across to the new leadership and their key staff at the earliest possible. Because work in Governor Perry's office. It's one thing to tell the person that's in charge of that issue today, and a completely different thing to, they haven't even decided how many chairs are going to be in the room that's going to look at the issues. Reviewing this issue in the future.
And that's the key. You don't have to get in front of the governor. You have to get in front of the governor's assistant for and convince them. And that's the person the governor is going to listen to, or the secretary is going to listen to.
I think in that regard, once again, this is Kate Howard. If you'll notice that all of the elected offices that we'll be looking at that will play an important role in what we'll be doing for the next 2 years, 4 years, they're using their social media sites and they're wanting to be used for. And I think that we as groups are what we think our cities and everything, we're encouraging them as they see problems in the rural areas to address, ask those questions on how they would handle them and everything on their social media sites, because it's kind of hard to ignore that when you're in a campaign mode, you know, and maybe have them work up their what we call their white paper, gray paper, or pink paper, whichever term they want to use, on how they're going to be focusing on that issue.
Okay. Well, I have 1:32, and I agree to make sure that we stick with our time frame. So, as I mentioned, I plan to have another call in November. Any suggestions on any kind of materials or things that you guys would like to see before the next one? Anything I could help, you know, that would help facilitate some of this?
Any links that were brought up in today's meeting, if those could be either re-provided or provided, that would be very helpful.
Okay.
Yes, I agree. It would be very helpful.
May have gone to Becky and didn't get passed to me, or got passed to me and fell further down the end basket tonight.
Okay. Well, the agenda for today is on the Housing and Health Services Coordination Council website, which if you just go to TDHCA's website and click on Program and Services, and then it's Council supported by TDHCA, and the links are included on the agenda, at least for the three documents that I shared. And also, my contact information is in there, so if anyone has additional information that they'd like to send to me that I could disseminate or post or include in the agenda item for the next call, that'd be great.
Would you put out a roster, again, if you have, of who we are?
Who
comprises, who is the committee? And are there persons who have not volunteered to be the committee but intend to be at the meetings, so that if we have ex officio communications among that they're included and they see the other things.
Okay, let me just share what I did this time. And this may be a little different than how the work groups were done before. I posted this meeting on a listserv. There are almost 1,700 people on the HHSCC listserv. So these work group meetings have basically been opened up to anybody who wants to attend. So the list that you have already, that's the council members. So other folks have just, like the first call, I think I had 10 people call in, and they were people that were just interested and wanted to be included in the discussion, but I didn't have any way of capturing their contact information or any of that. But
the ones that are on the work group, you're assuming I remember where that email is.
Oh, okay, no. I thought you just wanted to know, like, everybody. I was looking at the additional people in the room.
Well, I'm just saying, if folks over in the room don't mind being, you know, giving you their information so that there was something going on, they could be,
that'd be great.
Could be part of it.
Mm-hmm. That'd be great. But I will definitely send that out again of who all's on the work group. So I know three of you, but I think we had a fourth person too. But yeah, I can sure send that, Mike. Okay. Well, I want to thank everyone. Really appreciate it. And I will do the same thing next time. Just kind of watch our website. I'll send it out to the listserv. Links, agenda, and all that to everyone ahead of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate the discussion.
Thank you all.
Bye-bye.